if it might be a summoning, along the lines of the one Fogg used to harvest his cacodemons, or the spell that Julia and her friends had attempted at Moore with such disastrous results. But he didn't think so. This wasn't like any magic he'd ever seen before. Something about the spell made his fingers twitch. It was as if it wanted to be cast. He left the labyrinth and took it to Plum. "I've been reading through that spell," he said. "The one your great-grandfather left you."
"Uh-huh."
Plum was down in the basement, standing on a ladder and doing something involved to the joists. Quentin couldn't tell exactly what.
"It's interesting," he said.
"I would imagine.
I've really never seen anything like it."
"Uh-huh."
She put her palm on one massive beam and pressed, and it cracked and groaned, and the whole house seemed to shift slightly. Plum studied the results.
"Structural stuff," she explained.
"So you don't mind if I check it out a little further?"
"I give you my blessing."
"Don't you want to look at it yourself?"
She shook her head without looking at him. She was completely absorbed.
"From what I saw, I couldn't read the script. Can you?"
"More or less."
"Well, keep me apprised."
"I will."
Starting small, he began to make preparations. The spell would require the magical equivalent of a clean room at a semiconductor factory, so Quentin cleansed and warded the top floor in any and all ways he could think of. He shocked the walls and timbers and joists and whatever else so hard the dust jumped out of the cracks, and then he shocked the dust. Reluctantly, he took a wet cloth to his chalk labyrinth, but it had served its purpose. He floated a couple of big work tables up the stairs, bumping them against the walls of the stairwells and taking a few divots out of the plaster on the way, which Plum frowned at. He had to take them apart on the landing, because he'd misestimated the size, and they wouldn't go through the door. When you got down to brass tacks, the spell wasn't really one spell. It was more like 15 or 20 different spells, meshed together, to be executed in an overlapping sequence, and in some cases simultaneously. Some of them could be cast in advance, some the day before, but most, the really big stuff, had to be done on the fly, in the moment. He had trouble holding it all in his head at one time. But what was it Stoppard said? Give a nerd a door, he can close. It was a detour from his search for Alice, but they were effectively under house arrest anyway, and something hunchy and instinctive kept egging him on. He made cautious forays out into the city for supplies, creeping along under domes of magical camouflage. The walls of the top-floor workshop began filling up with old books, reference books, botanicals, atlases, huge black split-spined grimoires, the leather all craquelured like desert hardpan, in tall wobbly stacks that swayed worryingly if you brushed against them. The tables began to be populated by a weird menagerie of steel tools and brass instruments and odd asymmetrical glass containers. Even as he ground away at the technicalities, some of the larger functionality of the enchantment was becoming clearer to him, its outlines picked out in 1,000 trivial practical details. A lot of it seemed to have to do with space. There were spells in here designed to make it, literally to fabricate room, to weave together new space-time out of whole cloth. Here was a spell that expanded the space, blew it up like a balloon. This one shaped it. That other one stabilized the borders and made sure it didn't collapse again into the nothingness whence it came. But after that, it got really arcane and hard to follow. There were spells to summon matter into being. This part sucked entropy out of the system, forcing the matter to organize. These pushed it through a series of very obscure transforms, some of which appeared to do nothing at all, or cancel out earlier ones. There was a lot of fiddly magical matter stuff that would have mystified him if it didn't overlap in places with the page from the Netherlands. There was a whole laundry list of botanical spells, weather and water and wind magic, spells for shaping living rock.
There were some really head-cracking bits that looked like attempts to reset the basic physical parameters of the universe. Elementary charge, speed of light, gravitational constant. For all its elegant complexity, the spell had a primitive, primordial feel to it. It was an old working and a weird one, a relic of another age, of another world. It felt like it hadn't been cast in 1,000 years. One thing was clear. This was grand magic. It was sorcery on a scale he'd never attempted before, and it was going to test him severely. Until now, he'd been a journeyman magician, and a competent one, but if he could execute it, this spell would make him into a master. It would force him to become one. It would accept nothing less. Early one morning, a dawn thunderstorm woke him up, and as he was lying there wondering if he was going to be able to get back to sleep, an image of the whole thing appeared in his mind all at once. It assembled itself spontaneously, unbidden, as if it had been waiting for him to just get out of its way and let it form. There it was, dim and shimmering, but complete, with all its parts working together. It wasn't war magic. The spell didn't shield you, and it didn't hide you. It didn't kill, and it didn't summon something to kill for you. It wasn't going to restore Alice either, but it did do something wonderful. This was a spell that created something. It was a spell for making a land. He actually laughed out loud when he thought of it. It was too funny, too insane. But now that he saw it, he couldn't unsee it. He could follow it like a story that wound crookedly through the various sections and paragraphs and sub-clauses of the spell, like a thread of DNA. This thing was intended to make a little world. It was ruthlessly ingenious. It wasn't a cosmic act of creation, a thunderbolt from Olympus. It was much more subtle than that. It was more like a seed, the dry, tear-shaped germ of a little world, tiny, the kind of thing that could fall through a crack in a sidewalk, but full of sand and rain and stars and physics and life, all flattened and dried and compressed into words on a page. If you cast it right, it would expand and unfold into a place somewhere hidden away from the real world. A secret garden. Quentin could already see it in his mind's eye, fresh and new and still undiscovered. Green fields of matted grass, deep, silent lakes, the shadows of clouds all spread out beneath him like an Escher etching, the way the earth looked when he was a goose. Birds flitted between bushes, deer stalked stiff-legged through the woods. You wouldn't own it or rule it. But you could take care of it. You could have stewardship of it. Lying there in bed, in the half-light, rain spattering on the window, he forgot all about the bird and the couple and the money. All that seemed beside the point now. He forgot about break bills. He even let himself forget Alice for a minute. This was new magic, half enchantment, half work of art. He'd spent too long searching for new kingdoms. He wanted to make one of his own. A magical place. A place like Fillory. But not in Fillory. He would build it here on Earth. "I don't want to make you sound like a crazy person," Plum said. "But just then it sounded like you said you were going to make a land."
"I am. Or we are. We could. That's what it does, Rupert's spell."
Plum frowned. "I don't get it," she said. "You can't just make a land."
"It helps if you don't say it like that."
"You mean with rocks and trees and stuff?"
"That's exactly what I mean."
"Wow."
She stretched, then plunked her chin in her hands. They were having breakfast at their brand new IKEA dining table.
"Wow! Well, that would be a hell of a spell. Great-granddad wasn't much of a writer, but you gotta admit he was a pretty good thief.
Do you think it's actually possible?
I think we should find out.
But I don't get it. Why?
I mean, it's cool and all, but it sounds like a gigantic pain in the ass.
It was hard to put into words. The land would be a good place to hide from the bird, if they needed to hide, but that wasn't the point. This meant something to him. It would be like Prospero's Island, but in a good way. Not a country of exile, a model world, safe and peaceful and private. A magician's land. Plum, a highly perceptive person, could see that he wasn't going to change his mind. She sighed.
So if we do make a land, what does that make us? Are we like the gods of it?
I don't think so, Quentin said. I don't think this land would have any gods.
Or maybe it would.
But we'd have to make those, too. With Plum on board, or at least not actively resisting, things progressed more quickly. Quentin made contact with a very dodgy and unappealing wizard in the South Bronx who sold him a steaming, lightly buzzing metal box which he swore up and down contained a sample of unonactium, a synthetic element with an atomic number of 118, the very last entry on the periodic table. Its existence was still mostly theoretical. Laboratories had only ever put together a few atoms of it at a time, and ordinarily it decayed in about a millisecond. But the atoms in this sample were chronologically frozen, or at least vastly slowed down. Or at least they were supposed to be. It had cost him a good chunk of the money left over from his first day payment from the bird.
"Do you think it's really in there?" Plum studied the box skeptically.
"I don't know," Quentin said. "We'll find out."
"How?"
"The hard way, I guess." Quentin had a very expensive, very cool-looking staff purpose-built for the project. It was made of Pernambuco. The dense, black, almost grainless tropical wood cello bows are made of, and shod and chased with silver. Quentin didn't normally work magic with wands and staves, but in this case he thought he might need it as a last resort, a panic button if things were coming completely apart. He had to hide it all, to avoid attracting the bird's attention, but it went beyond that. Quentin was pretty sure the spell would be highly illegal from the point of view of magical society. There weren't very many laws among magicians, but synthesizing an entire land and concealing it inside a Manhattan townhouse would violate a goodly portion of them. So as far as magical energy was concerned, the house had to be watertight. The power levels required would be massive, too, and he could only be grateful they hadn't used up Mayakovsky's coins on the incorporate bond. He'd have to use one now. It wasn't what he'd made them for, but Quentin thought Mayakovsky would like the idea anyway. Quentin dug 7 long lines of Fillorian script into the hardwood floor of the workshop with a gouge and a mallet. He went at the ceiling, too, embedding long curls of platinum wire in the plaster. In places, he stripped the walls and nailed more wire along the bare studs. The only piece of the puzzle that was completely missing in action was that damned plant, the one from the Netherlands page. Incredibly, it had turned up in Rupert's spell as well. Quentin wasn't sure it was absolutely crucial, but either way, he still couldn't identify it, so they'd just have to scrape by without it. One night, after they'd both worked themselves into a state of exhaustion, he and Plum were lying limply on couches in the ex-disco room like they'd been flung there in the aftermath of an explosion. They were too tired to go to bed.
"So how big is this land of yours even supposed to be?" Plum said.
"I don't know yet. Not giant, I don't think. 10 acres, maybe? Like the 100-acre wood in Winnie the Pooh?
Except with 10.
"Yeah. I'm trying to specify it in a couple of places," Quentin said, "but it's hard to know exactly what goes where.
But it won't take up any space in the real world."
"I hope not."
"Quentin, why are you doing this?"
He recognized the importance of the question.
He was going to fall asleep right there on the couch. He felt like he was melting into it. But he tried to answer it before that happened.
What do you think magic is for?
I don't know. Don't answer a question with a question.
I used to think about this a lot, Quentin said. I mean, it's not obvious like it is in books. It's trickier. In books, there's always somebody standing by, ready to say, "Hey, the world's in danger, evil's on the rise, but if you're really quick and take this ring and put it in that volcano over there, everything will be fine." But in real life, that guy never turns up. He's never there. He's busy handing out advice in the next universe over. In our world, no one ever knows what to do, and everyone's just as clueless and full of crap as everyone else, and you have to figure it all out by yourself. And even after you've figured it out and done it, you'll never know whether you were right or wrong. You'll never know if you put the ring in the right volcano, or if things might have gone better if you hadn't. There's no answers in the back of the book. Plum was silent so long that Quentin wondered if she'd dozed off while he was talking. But then she said,
"So, what?"
"So you figured it out, and magic is for making lands?"
"No." Quentin closed his eyes. "I still have no idea what magic is for. Maybe you just have to decide for yourself, but you definitely have to decide. It's not for sitting on my ass, which I know because I've tried that. Am I making any sense?"
"You have not been making sense for some time."
"I was afraid of that."
"Well, it'll mean something when you're my age. You're what, 22?
21.
"Okay, well, I'm 30. "That's not that old," Plum said. "Don't patronize me."
"Fair enough. So, what do you think the land is going to look like?"
"I don't know that either," Quentin said. "I try to picture it sometimes, but it's always different. Sometimes it's meadows, sometimes it's an orchard, just rows and rows of apple trees. Maybe it looks like whatever you want it to."
"I hope it looks like the 100-acre wood," Plum said. "I think you should concentrate on that."
Chapter 20
Plum needed a night off. It was early April in Manhattan, and winter break was almost over at Brakeville's, but some of her former classmates were still in the city. Knowing they were so close, she was overcome by a fit of longing for her old life. She decided to indulge it. She wasn't even completely sure if she was still received in polite company after her dramatic departure from Brakeville's, so Plum was relieved when they turned up. The venue was a basement bar on Houston Street with a low ceiling and a lot of busted couches and a decent jukebox. It had survived untouched by the rage for elaborately perfect artisanal cocktails. Most of the old league was there, plus a few extras, including Horton. Their impending entry into the wider world seemed to have brought him and the leaguers together to the point where they were all more or less on the same side. Plum got the impression that the league had pretty much gone dormant in her absence anyway. Well, time to put aside childish things, as the verse saith. At least they'd gone out on top. They drank pints of IPA and attempted observational humor about the civilians or muggles or mundanes or whatever you wanted to call them all around them. They made bets about what people were feeling, and then Holly, who had a knack for it, did a mind-reading to see who was right. She couldn't get anything too specific, not words or images, just the emotional tone, but that was usually enough. Bars were a good place for it. Alcohol had a way of making people's minds more transparent, like oil on paper. Plum knew they were going to talk about Brakeville's, and she knew that it was going to hurt. It was partly what she came for, the pain. She was going to test her new sense of herself as someone who was past all that now, who'd had a taste of life in the real world, even though it was turning out to be something of an acquired taste. Fortunately, the pain, when it came, came in bearable quantities of ache. Hearing news from the candlelit bubble world of Brakeville's helped her mourn for the comparatively simple, hopeful Plum who used to inhabit that world.
Tonight would be a wake for that other plum, the plum who'd never tried that stupid prank. Rest in peace. She interrogated them methodically for gossip. They were absolutely teeming with it. With graduation coming, the fifth years were reverting to a state of nature. Everybody who'd been holding their breath for the past 5 years was letting it out. Even socially anxious, authority-respecting students had begun conducting risky experiments with sass. The candle-lit bubble world was on a collision course with the hard and rocky rogue planet of reality, and when they hit, the bubble would pop. And it was all happening without Plum. She felt like she'd been born too soon. She was a sickly, withered preemie next to a bunch of healthy, pink, full-term babies. Most of them already had post-graduation plans. Darcy was going to work for somebody who was working for a judge in the wizard's court. That word, wizard, being an anachronism that cropped up mostly in legal contexts. Lucy was going to assist some possibly fraudulent but indisputably famous artist who constructed enormous invisible magical sculptures in the sky above the city. Horton would be doing environmental stuff. Holly was part of a hardcore quasi-vigilante group bent on anticipating and averting violent crime among civilians. The others were busy planning to give themselves over to pleasure, or if not pleasure, then at least sloth. Life was already sorting them into categories, whether they liked it or not. All they could do was stare at each other dumbly across the widening gaps. Plum found herself sorted into an extra ad hoc subcategory of one. Nobody felt comfortable asking her about life after her career-ending, and from their point of view, essentially life-ending, disaster. So she volunteered that she was currently working with ex-professor Quentin Coldwater on an absolutely fascinating research project, the exact nature of which she couldn't reveal. Heads turned. This was gossip of the very first water, pure pharmaceutical-grade gossip. "Oh, my God," Darcy said, hand over her mouth. "Oh, my God, tell me you're not sleeping with him. Lie to me if you have to. I just want to hear the words." "I'm not sleeping with him. Jesus, what an idea." Fortunately, Plum didn't have to pretend to be appalled at the idea. Quentin was like her know-it-all older brother. "Who do you think I am?" "So you're just living and working with this mysterious, brooding older man 24/7, Chelsea said. "I have the phrase Girl Friday in my mind for some reason," Wharton said. "Guys, it's not anything like as intimate as you're imagining. We live in the same house. I'm assisting him on a project." "Because, see, any amount of intimate there would be, you know," Chelsea wrung her hands frantically, "squick." "I don't know," Lucy said loyally, raising the flag for the backlash to the backlash. "I mean, come on, guys. He's only, what, 40? "He's 30, Plum said. "Sorry, it's hard to tell with the, you know, the hair. I just meant that we're not in Humbert Humbert territory here. Not quite." "We are not in any territory at all. God, there is no territory." "All right, all right," Darcy held up her hands. "We surrender. For now. I just wish you'd give us a hint about what you are doing." Plum did. She'd had enough. Something in her wanted to rise to the challenge of defending herself and Quentin, too. At some point, she couldn't have said when, this had gone from Quentin's weird impulse project to something she cared about, too. She wanted it to work. "Look," she said, "I know it sounds weird, and I have total respect for everything you guys are doing. I do. Even if you're just going to get high all the time and make light shows on the ceiling." Chelsea gave the double V for victory sign. "Those are your paths, and they're awesome. I'm just on a different one, and it's definitely a path. But it's different because I don't know where it's going. What Quentin is doing, look, I don't want to get into details, but it's pretty brilliant. And he's after something real. He's taking a big risk. I like that.
I think one day I might want to do something like that, too.
She finished her beer in silence. Everybody was a little embarrassed that Plum had made a speech that wasn't self-deprecating or funny.
Well, so be it, she thought.
So,
Darcy broke the silence.
So you want to know what we're doing?
We're doing magic. And if it comes off, it's going to be a fucking masterpiece.
That was magic for you, right? One thing about magic, the real kind, it didn't make excuses, and it was never funny.
It wasn't completely true. They hadn't done any magic yet, but they would soon. The elaborate preparations in the fourth floor room were starting to have an effect. One morning, Plum walked in and noticed something funny about one of the windows, a little square one set in the back wall. It looked dark, like something was covering it from the outside, whereas the others were full of Manhattan sunlight. The window wasn't blocked, but the view had changed. It looked out at somewhere else now, or maybe somewhen else. A silent, steel-gray marshland in early evening. Miles of swaying, drowned grass in fading light stretching out to the horizon. Plum touched the glass. Where the other windows were cool, it was unseasonably warm. Weird. Where the hell is that?
I have absolutely no idea, Quentin said.
Plum was enjoying her stint as a sorcerer's apprentice more than she would have thought. Morale was high. Once she'd learned that Fillory really was real, she'd braced herself for an assault from her depressive streak. The revelation seemed like the kind of thing that would give her depression a scary power and substance, but instead, she'd found the news left her unexpectedly light and free, as if maybe it wasn't her Chatwinness at all, but rather the bracing against it that had caused her so much trouble over the years. They spent a long, cold day up on the house's flat, sticky tar-paper roof, finishing out the magical security up there. If any passing satellite happened to snap a picture, some truly weird shit was going to turn up on Google Earth.
"So tell me about Alice," Plum said.
She was painting sigils, black paint on black roof.
"I mean, more about her."
This kicked off a long pause from Quentin, and Plum wondered if she'd crossed a line. She knew the basic facts, but he hadn't been forthcoming with a lot of details, probably because he didn't want to talk about them. But Plum did. She figured since Alice almost killed her, probably she had the right to subject Quentin to a little exploratory interrogation. He obviously hadn't given up on his whole Alice project. It was lying fallow for the moment. But Plum wasn't fooled.
"What do you want to know?"
"What was she like? What kind of stuff was she into? That kind of thing. I mean, I met her ghost or niffin or whatever, but I didn't get a good sense of her day-to-day interests."
Quentin stopped working and stood up and massaged the small of his back.
"Alice was great. She was kind. She was funny. She was weird.
She was smart, smarter than me, and a better magician, too. She did things I still don't understand. It was sort of part of who she was. There was a force to her, a power, that I've never seen in anybody else."
"Were you in love with her?
I mean, I know you were boyfriend-girlfriend, but..."
"Totally,"
he smiled. "Totally in love. But I wasn't ready for her. She was more grown up than me. And I had a lot of stuff left to work out. I made some mistakes. I thought some things were important that really weren't."
Plum stood up, too.
She was wind-burned and tired, and the fabric of the seat of her pants disengaged from the roof in such a way as to suggest that the tar paper had probably wrecked them.
"I feel like you're talking around something here."
"Yeah. Probably it's that I slept with somebody else."
"Ah."
Kind of sorry she asked there, but Quentin kept going.
"Then she slept with somebody else. It was bad. I almost ruined everything. Then, just when I was starting to really figure things out, that was when she died.
That sucks. I'm really sorry.
It took me a long time to get over it.
Plum's own romantic history so far had been pretty limited, with minimal drama. It was one area where she felt comfortable lagging behind her peers. But she prided herself on her powerful philosophical insights into other people's relationships.
So if you do end up somehow, you know, bringing her back, do you think you'll be together? I mean, are you still in love with her?
I don't really know her anymore, Plum. It was a long time ago. I'm a different person now, or at least I hope I am. We'd have to see.
So you'd start over?
If she wanted to. Though I feel like we were only just about to get started. We wouldn't start over, we'd just start.
Deep orange rays of sunlight meandered past, slowed by the viscous urban air they were passing through, full of floating particulates and toxic emissions. Bubbles popped in Plum's knees.
Here's what I don't get. If you were so unready, if you had all that stuff left to work out, why do you think she loved you?
Quentin went back to mixing the smelly reagent he'd been working on before.
I don't know, he said. I never did know.
That would be a good one to figure out. Maybe before you bring her back?
The next morning was the dress rehearsal. They broke the enchantment down into its component spells, running through each of them individually, then in small groups, being careful all the while not to let them combine into anything that was actually live and volatile. In cases where the spell involved some exceptionally expensive component, or it was physically dangerous, they just mimed their way through it. Though once Plum forgot and spoke something she was supposed to skip, and just like that, there was a bright light and heat in the room. For an instant, it was unbearable, like when there's bad feedback in an auditorium.
Shit!
Quentin bolted, and she heard water running in the bathroom. When he came back, his fingernails were still steaming slightly.
Sorry,
Plum said. I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it.
Though you could tell he was annoyed.
Start over, from the beginning.
It was funny about magic, how messy and imperfect it was. When people said something worked like magic, they meant that it cost nothing and did exactly what you wanted it to. But there were lots of things magic couldn't do. It couldn't raise the dead. It couldn't make you happy. It couldn't make you good-looking. And even with the things it could do, it didn't always do them right. And it always, always cost something. And it was inefficient. The system was never airtight. It always leaked. Magic was always throwing off extra energy, wasting it in the form of sound and heat and light and wind. It was always buzzing and singing and glowing and sparking to no particular purpose. Magic was decidedly imperfect. But the really funny thing, she thought, was that if it were perfect, it wouldn't be so beautiful. On the big day, they agreed they would start at noon, but like anything else involving more than one person and a lot of moving parts, band rehearsals, softball games, model rocket launches, it took about 5 times longer to get ready than they planned. They cleared away the books and stacked them tidily in the corners, and they laid out all the tools and materials on trays, neatly labeled and lined up in the order they'd be needed in. Quentin stuck a list of the spells on the wall, like the set list for a gig. There were a lot of things that they had, by mutual consent, skipped in the dress rehearsal, but which it turned out were really time-consuming, like reading out the full text of one of these old cultic chants 10 times. They started in on the low-hanging fruit, making sure that conditions in the room were optimal and were going to stay that way. Constant temperature. A little extra oxygen, low light from the chandelier, no weird magical incursions. They cast spells on each other to ward off any weird charges or energies and to speed up their reaction times just a touch.
Some of this stuff you just couldn't cast right at baseline human speed. Caffeine helped with that, too, so they kept plenty of that around. The air in the workroom became still and cool, and it began to smell very slightly sweet. Jasmine, she thought, though she wasn't quite sure. She couldn't remember when they'd arranged that. By around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, they realized they were putting off casting anything that would take them past the tipping point, that would commit them to doing this thing right here and now, tonight, and not tomorrow or some other day. The train was still in the station. It could still be delayed. But they'd run out of bullshit prep work. It was in or out. Only now did Plum realize how nervous she was.
"I'm calling it," Quentin said. "If we're doing this, let's do it."
"All right. Go ahead and cast clarifying radiance."
"Okay.
I'll start prepping the Scythian dream."
"Check."
"Okay, go."
"Going."
She went.
Plum turned to the first set of materials on the shelf, 4 black powders in little dishes and a silver bell, clarifying radiance. Meanwhile, Quentin said a word of power, and the light in the room became a shade more sepia, like the sunlight moments before a thunderstorm. Everything began to sound echoey, as if they were in a much larger room. Just like that, they crossed the Rubicon. The train left the station. From that point on, it was controlled chaos. Sometimes they worked together. 1 or 2 of the spells were four-handed. Other times the flow diverged, and they'd be doing totally different spells in parallel, stealing glances at the other one's work to make sure they finished up at the same time. There was a steady flow of crosstalk. "Slow it down, slow it down. Finish in 3, 2.
Look out, the streams are forking. They're forking."
A single curve of Irish fire delaminated into 2, then 4, curling away to either side. The curls started pointing worryingly back toward Plum, who was casting them.
"I've got it," she said. "Damn it!"
The fire went out.
"Do it again, do it again. There's still time."
It went on like that for 3 or 4 hours. It was hard to keep track. By then they were deep into it, and the atmosphere in the room had gotten thoroughly dreamlike. Huge shadows stalked along the walls. The room seemed to list and bank, like it had taken flight with them inside it. She banged a tray down onto the work table in front of Quentin, and he began picking what he needed off it without even glancing down at it. And she was shocked to realize that it was the second-to-last spell on the list. This was almost it. Plum had run out of things to do, so she just watched him, drinking a glass of water she'd placed under the table when they started and had somehow managed not to kick over. The rest of it was all him. She was dizzy, and her arms felt weak. She folded them over her chest to keep them from shaking. Plum didn't think her friends would have made fun of Quentin at that moment. For a while, she'd fallen into the habit of thinking of him as a peer, basically. But over the past week, she'd been reminded that he was a decade older and doing magic on a different level from her. Right now, he looked like a young Prospero in his prime. He'd taken off his jacket and rolled up the sleeves of his white dress shirt, which was wringing with sweat. He must have been tired, but his voice was still firm and resonant, and his fingers were working with a practiced crispness through positions she'd never seen before, the tendons standing out on the backs of his hands. This was the kind of magic, Plum thought, she would do when she grew up. Big surges of power were flowing through the room. It crossed her mind that spells like this were exactly what turned people into niffins when they got out of hand. Huge tranches and structures of magic that so far she'd only ever seen in isolation were colliding and interacting like weather systems. The intensity doubled and redoubled itself. Without warning, the room juddered and dropped, leaving them in free fall for an instant. If it had been an airplane, the oxygen masks would have come down. Quentin's voice sounded artificially deep, and he'd started to tremble with the effort of keeping everything together. He hastily dragged an arm across his forehead.
"Staff," he said. "Staff!"
The second time he barked it loudly, and Plum snapped awake and turned and grabbed the black wood staff from where it stood, leaned up in one corner. He was hitting the panic button. Quentin grabbed the staff from her, quickly, blindly, and as soon as it was in his hands, it began jerking and vibrating, like it was attached to a line with an enormous fish on the other end, or a giant kite caught in a high wind. She moved to help him, but he shook his head. "Better not touch me," he said through clenched teeth. "Could be bad." The air was thick with the smell of burning metal and the sweat of tired magicians. She could sense it in the room with them now, the land itself. An angry, hungry, thirsty infant thing, demanding life, ready to take it from them if it had to. It cried out with an almost human voice. A spray of golden light erupted from between one of Quentin's fingers. That must have been one of Mayakovsky's coins going. Scenery raced past the windows, all of them now, too blurred to make out. Space distorted grotesquely, and for an instant the room looked stretched out of all proportion, fish-eyed, as if a bulbous blister had formed on the surface of reality itself. Plum was scared of what would happen if it burst. Quentin shouted in pain or triumph or despair. Plum couldn't tell which.
"No song!"
He spun the staff and banged the silver-shod end against the floor with a sound like a gunshot. She felt the shock through the soles of her feet. The wires in the ceiling and walls went red-hot, and the letters on the floor burned white like magnesium. Then they faded again, and bit by bit it all stopped. The floor stabilized. The air was still again. A couple of candles hadn't blown out, and their flames wobbled and then straightened up. Quentin collapsed forward onto the table. The room was silent except for a faint, high, silvery tone, though it could have been her ears ringing. The world outside the window had become Lower Manhattan again, even that odd little window in the corner. Quentin raised his head and straightened up. He peered around, up at the ceiling, into the dark corners of the room, curiously. He looked over at Plum. She pointed behind him. A red door had appeared in the wall. It was painted wood, banded with black iron, that had been worked into elaborate curves and fairy spirals. Quentin dropped the staff, and it clattered to the floor. Chapter 21 Plum watched him take a few slow, cautious, disbelieving steps toward the door, and then stop again as the dust settled and the ringing died away. Plum felt wrung out, shivery, like she'd gone for a run on an empty stomach, but she couldn't take her eyes off the red door. "We did it," Quentin said solemnly. "It really worked. We made a new land." It had one brass knob placed in the center. Quentin touched it and then put his hand on it hesitantly, as if he expected an electric shock or as if he thought his hand might go right through it. But it was solid. He turned the knob and pushed, wrong, then pulled the door toward him. It opened easily. A cold wind breathed into the room. It cooled Plum's overheated forehead, but it chilled something deeper inside her.
"Quentin," she said.
He didn't move, and she stepped forward to stand beside him on the threshold.
"Are you going in?"
Like he was waking from a dream, Quentin looked over at her. "In a minute." He held up his hand. "I was sure I was going to have a scar there from Mayakovsky's coin, like in Raiders. It felt like it was burning, but there's nothing." Plum had no idea what he was talking about, but she didn't say anything. It didn't seem like the moment. The land didn't look like the 100-acre wood. It wasn't even an orchard. It wasn't even outside.
Looking through the door was like looking in that mirror back at Brakebill's after Darcy's reflection had vanished. It was exactly like the room they were standing in, except for the fact that they weren't standing in it. And it was all reversed.
"Through the looking glass," Quentin said.
This wasn't what she'd expected. Quentin picked up a long-handled spoon from the work table and tossed it underhand through the doorway. It clanged and slid along the floor in the other room. It seemed safe enough.
"What is this?" she said.
"I think it's our land."
"But why does it look like that? Is that what it's supposed to look like?"
"I don't know."
"Was this what you were expecting? I thought you were going to do an orchard. Is this what you were trying to do?"
"No."
"Why would you make a land that looks exactly the same as the one you're already in?"
"That's a good question."
Quentin walked through the door and into the other room. She watched him look around. She had to hand it to him. He didn't look all that freaked out, just checking out the scene.
"Classic," he said.
"It's completely reversed. It's opposite land. You gotta like the respect for tradition." He spread out his arms.
"Come on in if you want to. I think it's safe."
Plum went on in. It really was the weirdest thing. It was like the house had acquired a Siamese twin attached to it at the door. She was struggling with a sense of anticlimax.
"It sort of worked," Plum said. "I mean, we did make a land, right?"
Quentin nodded.
"Or a house, anyway.
Let's be careful, Plum. This feels a little off." It was a very, very quiet house. The original house was magically soundproofed, so it was quiet, too, but this was different. This place was sonically dead. It was as if the walls were covered in that egg carton foam they used to line the walls in music studios. And there was something else. The place had a claustrophobic feel. She couldn't put her finger on it till it was literally staring her in the face.
"Look at the windows," she said. "All the windows. They're not windows. They're mirrors."
It was like the eyes of the house had gone blind.
"Huh. I wonder what the mirrors are."
"Yeah, good question. There was one in the little half-bath out on the landing. She steeled herself for some horror movie shocker, and then poked her head in." Curiouser and curiouser. The mirror was still there, and it was still a mirror. But inside the room in the mirror, it was snowing. Blowing snow, bordering on a real blizzard. It was starting to drift on the floor, the towel racks, the rim of the sink. It settled on her hair and her eyelashes, but only in the mirror. Reflexively, she touched her hair, but it was dry. The snow wasn't real. Quentin appeared behind her.
"Eek," he said.
Clearly, this was affecting them in different ways. They strolled through the house, lord and lady of their uncanny new domain. Everything was there, more or less, except when it wasn't. The furniture, the drapes, the silverware, the glassware. The doors were ordinary doors. But there were no computers and no phones. The books were there, but the pages were blank. No toiletries in the bathroom, no clothes in the closets. Nobody lived here. Water came out of the taps, but cold only. They disagreed over whether one of the oriental rugs was left-right inverted. Quentin was sure it was, but Plum remembered it differently, and neither of them felt like going back and checking the original. Fatigue and disappointment were giving them both a slightly hysterical edge.
"It's like a giant closet," Plum said. "We could store stuff in here. We'd have more closet space than anybody in New York City."
"We're not going to store stuff in here."
"Put a couple of flat screens in here, Xbox, easy chair, man cave."
They'd made their way up to the top floor again when they heard a heavy clunk from the floor below, her bedroom. I guess that's the other shoe, Quentin said. Wands out, Harry. Plum snorted charitably because she was a good person, but she took his point. She went defensive, a nice, hard blocking spell. Charge it up and you could hold it back till you needed it. It would just take a gesture to release it. Whatever Quentin was prepping, it gave off a high, rising whine. But when they got there, the bedroom was empty, except that Plum's desk chair was now lying on its back, its little feet in the air, like it was playing dead.
Ah, they got me!
Slowly, Quentin lifted it up and set it on its feet. The chair fell over, he said brightly.
All right, all right.
It was like they were daring each other to be the first to lose their nerve. They tromped downstairs to the second floor. Another thing, color photographs had faded to black and white. I wonder, but Quentin was cut off by that same clunk as before, from over their heads now. The chair again.
Huh.
Neither of them wanted to look. I wonder what's outside.
I don't, Plum said, and I dare you to not look.
For a second, they both thought there was something in Quentin's bed, but he jerked the covers back, and it was just a pillow. This was seriously creeping her out. Something shattered downstairs in the kitchen. It sounded like somebody dropping a wine glass. Obediently, they both trotted downstairs, Quentin first. Lo, a lone wine glass lay in pieces right in the middle of the floor.
Looky there.
Must have been the wind, Plum said.
Now she was doing it. Her shrink would say she was using humor to avoid deeper feelings. She would be right. They rummaged around aimlessly. They were both hoping to stumble on something that would make the land exciting and magical and romantic the way they were hoping it would be, but they didn't. She didn't like this land. It was like they'd dialed a wrong number. This wasn't what they'd ordered. I wonder if there's food here, if you can eat it, Quentin said. She nerved herself to open the fridge. There had been a bowl of green grapes in it, but the grapes had become green glass marbles. Quentin was picking up books one after the other and opening them.
Dude, they're all going to be blank.
Maybe. This isn't what I expected, but I don't know why it's not what I expected. It felt right when we were casting it, but something must have gone wrong. He put the book down and walked boldly over to the front door, but before he could open it, there was a muffled thud from the second floor. It might have been a lamp falling over onto a rug. He stopped, his hand on the doorknob.
Quentin,
I know, he said. This is definitely a land, but I'm not completely sure it's our land.
Whose, then?
He shook his head. He didn't know. It was literally everything she could do not to start humming, "This land is your land."
Well, we made it, Plum said.
I know, I know. Want to go see who knocked over the lamp?
Let's go.
She followed Quentin up the stairs, but he stopped halfway, listening. Why do I feel like we're getting decoyed here? He turned around and edged past her, back down the stairs. I'll be right back.
Famous last words.
She watched him reach the bottom of the stairs and freeze, staring at something out of view.
Shit! What is it?
Except that she knew, even as she was asking him, there were blue highlights on the polished banister next to him. She knew that blue.
Run!
He pelted up the stairs at her, white-faced.
Jesus, run!
He would have run straight over her if she hadn't snapped out of it and taken off like a shot ahead of him. It shouldn't be here. It was like something from a dream had followed her into the real world, or maybe it was the other way. She'd followed it into the dream. Quentin covered a lot of ground with those long legs. He overtook her on the second floor, sprinting right past her, but he grabbed her hand as he passed her and pulled her along, practically yanking her arm out of its socket. He barked his shin hard on an ottoman as he ran, which must have hurt like hell.
Run, run, run! Come on!
On the third floor landing, Quentin paused and sent a spell down the stairs over her shoulder, something that flashed hot on her face. Then they were running shoulder to shoulder up the stairs and into the workroom and through the door and out into the real world. She slammed the door behind them, then blasted out the blocking spell she'd had ready for good measure. She'd totally forgotten about it till then. The air in front of the door shivered. They looked at each other, both breathing hard.
I don't, Quentin panted, think she can come through.
He looked like he was going to cry, or be sick, or both. She really hoped he did neither of those. They shouldn't have cast the spell. Jesus, how stupid did you have to be? Ancient enchantment rouses primal horror. It was the oldest story there was. Hubris. They were such idiots.
How the fuck did she get here?
Plum gasped. Quentin didn't answer. His face looked weird. Happy and sad and terrified all at once. Chapter 22. Quentin didn't sleep that night. He did try, because it seemed important, because sleeping was something you did at night, but it was never going to happen. After a couple of hours of staring at the ceiling, shivering, his mind spinning and lurching like a dryer with a shoe in it, he gave up and got dressed and climbed the stairs to the fourth floor. It was 3 in the morning. He stood in front of the red door for a good half hour, nervously jiggling his knee, clenching his jaw till it ached. Then he began plastering himself with wards and boosting his reflexes and doing whatever else he could think of that might come in handy. He was going back through. The safeguards were probably beside the point. Alice had been stronger than him when she was human, and now she was on another power scale entirely. Now she was plugged into the main line. But he had to get closer to her. He didn't understand why she was here. Maybe he'd summoned her somehow, without even knowing it, trapped her and bound her in this weird mirror house. Maybe she'd come on her own. Alice had found him at Breakbills, and now she'd found him again, here, wriggled her way into his land, like a worm into an apple. She was the snake in his Eden. It didn't really matter. He hadn't managed to make a land, or not much of one. But this was better. Making a land was a distraction anyway. So was the robbery. This was what he wanted. But what did Alice want? To haunt him? Laugh at him? Hunt and kill him? The scholarly literature on Niffins was pretty thin. Their behavior was unpredictable at best, but whatever she wanted, he knew what she needed, and that was to be human again. He couldn't have asked for a better chance. And he needed her, too. He needed to see her again. She was the only person he'd ever felt completely at home with. He knew he should wait and eat and sleep and talk it over with Plum, but, he told himself, it was hard to know how long he had. The whims of a Niffin were pretty much the definition of perverse. If she left now, he might never see her again. He was going to finish this. And plus, Plum would try to talk him out of it. The house was quiet. He wasn't even remotely tired. Staring at the red door, he tried to summon up in his mind the Alice he knew. Did he really remember what she was like? Maybe he was pursuing a ghost, the ghost of a ghost, a figment of his own memory. It had been 7 years. That was longer than he'd known her as a human. Maybe he was chasing some long-gone, never-was fantasy Alice. If he could bring her back, who would she be? Quentin was going to find out. He opened the red door, but didn't cross the threshold. The other room was still there, the mirror room, with its mirror windows. He sat down on the floor, cross-legged, and waited. He'd been sitting there for 10 minutes, when Alice swam by slowly, in profile, her legs trailing lightly behind her, as silent and malevolent as a shark in an aquarium. She was slightly smaller than she had been in life, like an expensive doll of herself. She didn't see him. If she knew he was there, she didn't bother to turn her head.